So I propose that instead of discussing if XDR-TV is new or not, let's focus how giving a name to something that has been out there already for quite a long time can help us to understand better how to work in order to control TV. XDR-TV was a term coined last year. It was in the MMWR report when the word was introduced for the first time, and it has been very useful to understand a bit better how MDR-TV and how drug resistance has been evolving over time. Issues like quality of drugs, patients adhering to treatment, medical prescription of the right treatment are certainly the fundamental factors contributing to the creation of the emergence of MDR-TV and XDR-TV. And we can see the sequence of events occurring over time. Certainly, when we have given a name to something, we are in better position to measure it. And in starting to measure what's going on in terms of drug resistance worldwide is a process that began in 1994 with the WHO and Union World Resistance Surveys. What we can see here is the map of XDR-TV after introducing this variable in the reports from the Supranational Reference Lab. Then you can see that it's a phenomenon that is basically occurring wherever second-line drugs are being introduced. Along the symposium, there will be opportunity for their colleagues to expand on several of the issues emerging on XDR-TV. At this point, I would like to invite my colleague, Matteo Zignol, from the Stop TV department to share with us what is the evidence that has emerged so far about the interaction of XDR-TV, MDR-TV, and HIV.
Thank you.
Matteo, to introduce Dr. Matteo Zignol, who is also with WHO, based in the same team, trained in Italy and specialized in infectious diseases. I can give you the introduction for Ernesto also, if you want, at the end of the presentation. But go ahead, Matteo.
Thank you, and good afternoon to everybody. I will take 10 minutes to try to answer this question. What do we know about the association between HIV and MDR-TB epidemics globally? If you look at the literature, published literature, you will see that the large majority of the studies looking at HIV and MDR-TB association are basically reports of institutional outbreaks. This is true both for industrialized countries, but also for developing settings. What is really important is that one of the conclusions of the large majority of these studies is that basic institutional infection control is sufficient to contain transmission in institutions. This table shows you some of the papers I was referring to. I took this table from a manuscript that has been published last summer in JID. We are more or less all familiar with the outbreaks and that happened in New York, in Italy, in Spain, in Argentina. And what is really striking is the column that look at the death rate. You see the death rate is over 70%, but reaching almost 100% in some settings. And the median time to death is of only a few weeks. This is in institutional settings, hospital, prisons. What do we know about the association between MDR-TB and HIV in the general population? Unfortunately, we don't know much. Those are some studies published in the past few years. The large majority, as you see, from Africa, Tanzania, Botswana, South Africa, Mozambique, Malawi, where they were designed to look at this association, MDR and HIV. And they basically found, most of them, no association. Why? Well, I think the majority of the studies were conducting high prevalence settings, but low MDR-TB prevalence settings. And this has an impact on the statistical power of some of these studies. The methodologies are difficult to compare, and in some of them, the association may be confounded by some factors like the history of a previous treatment or the history of hospital stay. HIV infection and MDR-TB, the perfect storm. This is the title of a very nice review paper authored by several people that are in this room today that was published last summer in JID. I really encourage everybody to read it, and I took some of the findings of this review for some slides. The authors, at the end of their review, basically suggest that the convergence between HIV and MDR-TB epidemic could lead to a sort of perfect storm. If you look at this map, which shows the estimated HIV prevalence in new TB cases, this is published by WHO in the Global TB Report, you see that, for example, in countries of Southern Africa, more than 50% of new TB cases are estimated to have HIV. But in other settings like South America or the countries of the former Soviet Union, the proportion is not irrelevant. It's like between 5 and 20%. If you try to compare this map with these other two maps that describe the proportion, the estimated proportion of MDR-TB among new cases and among retreatment cases, you will see that in some areas of the world, there is an overlapping of the two epidemics. In particular, of course, in the countries of the former Soviet Union, where the HIV epidemic is growing and MDR-TB epidemic is a serious problem, but also in countries of this part of the world, in Southern Africa, where HIV is, of course, is a really serious epidemic, and MDR-TB was considered not that serious, but we are starting to see emerging. In the next few slides, I'll try to go region by region very quickly to describe what kind of data is available. This is the Western Pacific region, and Henan Province is one of the very highly populated Chinese province, where MDR-TB has been found to be almost 8% among all cases, and HIV among all cases has been found to be up to 15% in some villages. Those rates are quite important, particularly if you consider, you know, the population of that country. This is another report from Southeast Asia. We are talking about Tamil Nadu state in India. It's a small study looking at MDR-TB among a group of HIV-positive cases, and they found a prevalence between 4.4 and 5.9. In JID paper that I showed you earlier, the authors did some rough and crude estimate and suggest that in India, every year, there may be between 4.5 and 6,000 HIV-infected persons that develop MDR-TB. What about Eastern Europe? This is Latvia, and it's one of the Baltic states where the HIV epidemic sort of was initially recognized towards the end of the 90s. You can see it has increased since then, both among all TB cases, but between 0 and 10% in 2005, but also among the population MDR-TB cases. And this country is a country where XDR-TB is a serious problem, which almost 7% of MDR-TB cases that are XDR. Ukraine is another country of Eastern Europe. Those are really recent data. HIV among new patients was found to be 15.4% and 18.6% in the civilian and penitentiary sector. But what is more interesting is the association with MDR-TB. The table shows you the results of a recent DRS in Donetsk Oblast, where they found 15.5% of MDR-TB among new and 41% among retreatment. And of course, proportions are higher in the penitentiary sector. And they, what is very interesting, they found that MDR-TB was associated with, of course, history of previous treatment. We all know that. History of imprisonment, but also with the HIV status.
2 minutes, Matteo.
Yeah. What about Africa? Well, we all know about this report. It's about 53 cases of XDR-TB that were found in KwaZulu-Natal. Well, I just want to point out that probably they were all HIV positive and the death rate was close to 100%. And Botswana is another country where HIV among TB was found to be between 60 and 83%, and where 3 surveys showed an increase of any resistance between 1996 and 2002, a significant increase. So, which are the consequences of the HIV and XDR-MDR-TB convergence? Well, first of all, high mortality. And this is true even among patients on ARVs. Second, increased complexity of clinical management. Third, the possibility of lower patient adherence. And fourth, high transmission of MDR-TB, particularly in nosocomial settings. Which are the policy implications on the association between HIV and MDR-TB? Well, first of all, we should never forget to stress strengthen basic TB control, which implies, for example, strengthening laboratories, improving laboratory capacities in those countries. The second point is to improve surveillance activities. We know very little about this association, and countries should have their own data to try to plan and to address this issue. The third is to include MDR-TB management in the collaborative activities between TB and HIV control programs. The fourth, it's extremely important, is to really implement infection control measures, especially in healthcare facilities. And all the studies talking about institutional outbreaks basically conclude with this message. We need to strengthen infection control measures. And now it's time to really work in countries to implement those. And the last one is to integrate patient-centered approaches to promote treatment adherence. This was my last slide. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Matteo. Only 30 seconds over. We have a short period of time for any clarifications, if anybody would like to get to the microphone. If not, we will move on to the next speaker. I think those are people coming in rather than going to the microphone. Somebody's going the other way. No. Okay, thank you very much, Matteo and Ernesto. We'd now like to call upon Dr. Timothy Hulse to talk about screening for XDR-TB in high-burden HIV settings. Tim is an epidemiologist who's been with the Centers for Disease Control since 1999, working on tuberculosis since 2002, mainly in the Baltics and Southern Africa. Tim, the floor is yours.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for inviting me to speak this afternoon. It's fantastic to see a room full of people to discuss a topic such as resistance to second-line drugs in our MDR patients from what started as a couple of relatively unnoticed abstracts 2 years ago by CDC and WHO at the Paris meeting to now I see as several roomfuls of people in several sessions. this week, and it's hopefully going to result in more rapid and appropriate treatment for our patients. Today I will be discussing a proposed screening algorithm for MDR and XDR in high HIV prevalence settings. Briefly going over the importance of the HIV-TB interaction and associations that we know, although much of this was just done by Mateo, so I can go rapidly through that, discuss a proposed the issues around screening for MDR and XDR, and then our proposed algorithm for screening TB suspects. We know that HIV is one of the strongest risk factors for those infected with MTB to develop tuberculosis from the baseline risk up to a tenfold increased risk if HIV is present. Given that one-third of the world's population is infected with TB and there are over 9 million cases, it's no surprise that TB is one of the leading opportunistic infections and cause of death in people living with AIDS. Due to these excessive TB burden in our patients living with HIV has resulted in overwhelmed health services in many regions, including the one we're located in now. And as a result, we've seen poor adherence and high default rates. There are also many other issues around drug supply and laboratory supply, which are being discussed at this meeting. And in some, these have resulted in some settings in low cure rates and programs, and we've seen increasing amounts of anti-TB drug resistance. This is from the WHO guidelines for the programmatic management of drug-resistant TB. The risk factors for drug resistance have been fairly well studied. We know that the strongest association is previous treatment for TB, most importantly in those who have chronic tuberculosis and or failures of Category 2 regimens, as well as in patients who have default and those who have relapsed. All contacts of MDR-TB cases are especially at risk of drug resistance, and if you add HIV into that mix, it increases the risk even more. And also those who are sputum smear positive at 2 or 3 months, depending on the program of your standard course chemotherapy, this may also be predictive of imminent treatment failure. Other reported risk factors for drug resistance include TB treatment in the private sector, exposure in institutions with MDR-TB outbreaks, as Mateo said, poor quality anti-TB drugs, which we know to be an important issue, treatment in non-DOTS programs, hospitalization or incarceration, and thus the risk of outbreaks, but also residents in high MDR-TB prevalence areas. HIV, as Mateo mentioned, has been linked to development of drug resistance, but it is not a causative factor as far as we know. So that's the important issues as have been discussed. High mortality in persons with MDR and HIV with high death rates that is occurring rapidly in as short a time as from 4 to 8 weeks from TB diagnosis. But also importantly, some patients' HIV is not even diagnosed. And thus, we know that HIV-infected patients at risk of MDR-TB are those that are in the most greatest need of rapid diagnosis. So in summary, the known associations that were reviewed in the article, as Mateo mentioned, are poor treatment outcomes in programs that are overstressed and under-resourced, undiagnosed and inadequately treated HIV infection, namely inadequate rollout of heart, poor infection control practices, as we have seen in the cluster of XDR-TB cases in South Africa, inadequate treatment for drug-resistant TB, including the lack of rapid diagnostic tools and the lack of access to some second-line drugs. Acquired rifamycin resistance has been well documented and is one association we know to be the case between HIV and drug resistance. Malabsorption of anti-TB drugs is also thought to be a concern. And also in some areas, as Ernesto mentioned, uncontrolled use of second-line anti-TB drugs. Mateo did show this graph of increasing drug resistance in the neighboring country of Botswana, which has had in the past a very good TB control program, yet despite that, is seeing increases in the amount of drug resistance in the 3 surveys that they've done. So at the risk of losing my government job, I hope Dr. Castro is not here, in the wake of several high-profile MDR cases that boarded transatlantic flights between Europe and the United States and back, there were many calls for screening for tuberculosis in our country. Luckily, none of us have had to get an X-ray at the airport. But I will discuss now the issues around screening for MDR-TB and XDR-TB. A general paradigm or general framework for reviewing this is both active screening of the population and passive screening of population that can occur. Active screening being comprised of drug resistance surveys where the health system identifies and tests a representative sample with an adequate sample size versus passive surveillance, which would include universal culture or DST in well-defined groups which are reported to TB program and which receives, analyzes, and interprets them. This, of course, is not possible in many countries. We move on then to active screening of individuals, which would be comprised of contact investigation, where the public health system tracks down contacts of patients with drug-resistant TB and tests those contacts, the close contacts, for TB, versus passive screening or case finding, as we call it, where each healthcare provider is testing a symptomatic patient on a case-by-case basis. So the important considerations for rapid identification of MDR-TB and XDR, which I think is where we are at this point in the epidemic, as Matteo said, the perfect storm, is that rifampin resistance, we feel, is a critical entry point, as it is the most important first-line drug in the treatment. And so rifampin resistance in many places, RR, basically is equated with MDR in most settings. The negative predictive value of these rapid rifampin tests is quite high, and that's a very good indicator for the use of a screening test. HIV-positive suspects that have a rapid test for rifampin resistance also are in need of treatment while awaiting their final DST, and this is currently in place in many countries, and I know that it's true in the Baltic states where I work. We know that we're increasing the body of evidence base for policy around empiric treatment and access to the array of drugs, and as has been mentioned, the guidelines for the management of MDR-TB are currently being revised and are due out next year to build that evidence base. Importantly, HIV-infected smear-negative contacts of persons with MDR-XDR-TB may also need rapid diagnosis and possible treatment and is an area that needs further discussion. And then HIV-infected suspects with extrapulmonary TB in children also need consideration. I'm not going to dwell on these newer resistance test methods. I'm sure you've all been to sessions this meeting where there's been a lot of talk about these exciting new tests that are on the way, and my next speaker will also be discussing this. Just suffice it to say that these tests can be done directly on sputum and be given results in 1 to 3 days. That includes the molecular test that we know, looking for the genetic mutations RPOB and CATG. Some of these are point of care, and some are mostly based in reference laboratories, which is an issue around rapid screening. There's been a lot of talk in 2007 about the commercial automated liquid culture, and this algorithm rests heavily upon that. It's now the standard in developed countries. It can be done on both smear positive and smear negative sputum, despite slightly high contamination rates and issues around cost. You do get results in 3 to 4 weeks. And these second-line drug, the DST second-line being done in liquid culture, has been validated in 2 studies, and this, the use of this method has been supported by the STAG meeting in March of 2007, and there are also other culture methods which I won't discuss. So the challenges of rapid diagnosis in the high HIV prevalent settings for many countries is that first-line DST on solid media is not readily accessible. A country I came from last week in Mozambique, until last week, actually didn't have a phone or a fax or an internet access in their lab, and they also have no microbiologist in any tuberculosis laboratory in the entire country. They are doing first-line DST and quite ably so, and are passing their proficiency testing, but there's a real need for a scale-up of laboratories. Notably, though, liquid culture is only available in a few reference labs, especially in this region, and as I've already mentioned, some technologies are point-of-care, others are more referral hospital-based. We also have to consider what is the expected outcome of these of rapid diagnostic algorithms. Are we aiming for earlier conversion, earlier higher cure rates, or reduced transmission, or a combination of all of the above? And also, as I've mentioned, there is the issue about the role of empiric treatment. So to move on to the proposed algorithm for TB suspects at high risk of MDR-TB, it includes these crucial things: ensuring infection control precautions in all settings in which we see HIV-infected clients, performing 2 AFB smears based on the new revised definition of pulmonary tuberculosis, and conducting HIV testing, whether you call it provider-initiated or opt-in or opt-out, whatever it is, on all TB suspects. Again, especially those who are at risk of rifampin resistance. This algorithm, as I will discuss, includes the rapid identification of people who are at high risk needing a rapid test based on the risk factors which I discussed earlier, and again ensuring infection control in these settings, and then performing smear tests and HIV tests on all TB suspects. Those who are smear negative will go into the algorithm of the management of smear negative TB suspects based on their HIV status that was published last year, I believe, in 2006 by WHO. Those who are smear positive and are grouped into the four groups you see here based on their rapid RIF test result and their HIV test result. And I will go through these one by one, spending most time on the first group, which are those who are HIV infected and rapid rifampin test positive. In these patients, we would recommend performing rapid liquid-based culture and DST on all first and second-line drugs. I know there's a statement to be coming out forthcoming this year about second-line drug testing, so this would algorithm would take that into account. It would include rapid transport to the reference lab if full DST is not yet available locally. Confirmation is always required based on using solid media culture and DST. And then, as I mentioned, empiric treatment with four or more effective second-line drugs based on the WHO guidelines and also on lab survey data that's known and the history, especially of second-line drug use in the patient, pending full DST. Also consider the use of auxiliary drugs, as was discussed in this morning's session by Dr. Daly, and again, always ensuring adequate ARV treatment, ensuring infection control, and initiating that contact investigation. The second group would be those who are HIV infected but rapid RIF test negative. This population is also at risk of MDR, and the algorithm is similar, as you can see, performing rapid liquid-based culture and DST for first and second-line drugs, rapid transport, the confirmation on solid media culture, following the WHO TB treatment guidelines from 2003, of course, starting ARVs as rapidly as possible, pending given their CD4 count and viral load, and then adjusting treatment according to the WHO guidelines for the programmatic management of drug-resistant TB. For those who are HIV negative but rapid RIF test positive, again, there's a little duplication here, performing liquid-based culture, transport, confirmation on solid media, treatment, empiric treatment with four or more effective second-line drugs based on that rapid rifampin test, adjusting the management according to the guidelines, and again, ensuring infection control. And lastly, the fourth group, who are HIV negative and rapid RIF negative, of course, we hope most patients fall into this category. If they are smear positive, you would follow the WHO treatment guidelines and order a solid media culture and DST. Of course, though, there are limitations to this algorithm. The availability of this test is an issue. It's being, as will be discussed in the next the speaker, being tested in many pilot projects, including in this country. But rapid RIF tests, right as of now, have not been rolled out in many settings. The lab infrastructure has needs. There are biosafety issues, and the number and training of lab personnel needs to be adequate. There also has to be a general infrastructure for transportation and telecommunication to make sure these results are transmitted quickly. There are also issues of cost and available resources in settings versus their need. But we feel that it is time to start discussing more rapid diagnosis of drug resistance in our patients. To conclude, we feel that HIV testing of all TB suspects combined with rapid detection of rifampin resistance can lead to earlier diagnosis, treatment, and reduced transmission. The simple algorithm that's been presented here today, ensuring adequate infection control, rapid detection of rifampin resistance and HIV can identify those requiring empiric therapy and adjustment based on known guidelines. And the institution of rapid diagnosis, as discussed, has several challenges, but I think those can be overcome. I'd like to acknowledge my fellow colleagues on this paper. Thank you. Was I within time?
1 minute over, so you're okay. Is there any question for clarification? I also want to point out that we have left some time at the end of the presentations for more discussion. So if you could limit questions to clarifications for now. Okay, if not, thank you very much, Tim. We're going to pick up on the issue of rapid diagnosis of MNXDR-TB, which will be elaborated by Rick O'Brien, currently with the Foundation for Innovative New Diagnostics in Geneva, previously long history of experience in MDR-TB at both WHO and CDC. Rick?
I think maybe I've turned off an essential component of the system.
Could we have technical assistance, please, for the presentations? Is there anybody up there?
While we're bringing up my presentation, John Ritterhoff, who's head of the newly named Global Laboratory Initiative, and I are competing to see who can give the same talk the greatest number of times in the conference. And so if you've heard this before or a variant of it, I beg your indulgence, but hopefully there are a few people who have not heard me talk yet. One more screen up. So thank you to the organizers for inviting me to give this presentation. What I want to do in this hopefully brief talk is to talk a little bit about the scope of the challenge of scaling up capacity to address MDR and XDR-TB and HIV-associated TB, focus largely on growth-based detection systems that are available and can be implemented, importantly liquid culture and DST commercially available and automated, and the MOD system, but to point out that there is rather rapid and fairly low-cost direct testing on solid media with colorimetric readouts, such as the GREAS method, that produces very reliable results in as little as 10 to 14 days on smear-positive specimens. FOS-based detection and the one commercially available assay, the FASTPLAC test, gives reasonably reliable results in only 2 days, but has two main limitations. One, it's very labor-intensive, and the other is that it has variable numbers of or variable rate of indeterminate results that can be as high as 20% on one-plus smear-positive specimens, so that is an important consideration and drawback. Talk a bit about implementation of rapid molecular methods for the diagnosis of MDR-TB that we really see may, in a few years, transform the way that we are able to screen and actually diagnose MDR-TB. And although I have it on here, implementation of rapid second-line drug susceptibility testing, I'm not going to cover this, but only to say that the Global Laboratory Initiative, WHO, will be coming out with guidelines on second-line DST on liquid media, that we hope will be rapidly scaled up in labs that are currently doing high-quality liquid culture for DST on the first-line drugs, and mention that there's at least one company that's working on a molecular assay for XDR-TB. So in the next few years, that could become available. In response to the crisis of XDR and MDR-TB that was highlighted last year, and led to the Global XDR Task Force meeting at WHO last October that was alluded to, there's been a call for significant expansion of capacity to perform diagnostic evaluations for suspected TB patients, importantly expanding culture and drug susceptibility testing. And this just shows, we have various estimates going on, but suggesting that smear examination needs to increase from 80 million a year to 200 million a year, culture capacity from 10 up to 60 million a year, and just to point out that in the developed world, roughly 5 million cultures a year are performed. In the developing world, 5 million, but nearly all of those 5 million in South Africa, Russia, and Brazil, leaving the rest of the world with several hundred thousand cultures needing to expand up to 60. And for drug susceptibility testing, from a very small number up to 5 or 6 million per year. So it's a significant challenge. and the funding required up to $2.5 billion. So a huge, huge challenge, but one that we are beginning to address and initiate. Moving on to growth-based detection of MDR-TB, this requires a culture-capable laboratory meeting BSL-3 standards as defined by WHO that can be implemented in resource-limited settings and don't require the sophisticated design and infrastructure that we commonly think of as BSL-3 in the developed world. There's been limited experience in establishing such laboratories in resource-limited settings, but FIND, Partners in Health, and WHO are working on a project in Lesotho where, following a detailed assessment by those organizations and memoranda of understanding between the groups, led to upgrading of the laboratory, hiring and retraining of laboratory personnel, and particularly important, provision of ongoing technical assistance in the form of a highly trained, skilled laboratorian coming from outside, working for FIND on the ground now for about 6 months, and will be staying at least a year. And we think this kind of assistance is crucial, and there's significant limitations in the availability of such human resources, but crucial in establishing quickly quality performing labs for culture and DST. Liquid culture and DST, as Tim mentioned, is sort of the state of the art in the developed world. It's been seldom used in lower income settings because of increased costs and technical challenges, particularly high rates of bacterial contamination. Our projects, demonstration projects in 4+ sites, looked at the evaluate the feasibility, cost, and impact of the systems, and produced data for a WHO policy that was issued just last month and is available on the WHO website, guidance on implementation of liquid culture and DST, which is importantly cautious because there are significant concerns, the first being biosafety, as I mentioned, because this is liquid culture and manipulating cultures for drug susceptibility testing. Biosafety is an important consideration. Procurement and supply logistics have been particularly challenging with long delays in customs and shipment, and that relates very directly to inventory management because certain reagents have very short shelf life, such as 6 months, so it's not been uncommon for labs in these projects to actually have consumables expire before they were used. Several sites have had challenges in providing for reliable backup electrical supply because of electrical outages are frequent in these settings. Training has been not challenging, but there's certainly a requirement for intense training, both on and off-site training, followed by access to ongoing technical assistance should be available. The company that's providing this, if it's it is a commercial system, should have a credible customer support plan for servicing and following up technical assistance. The contamination rates that have been invariably high when this is introduced have been addressed, but will remain to be challenging in labs that are moving to this system. And then finally, species identification, because non-tuberculous mycobacterial isolates are more common than on solid systems, so every mycobacterial isolate has to be confirmed by a species identification as a must. We have a low-cost immunochromatic lateral flow assay that performs quite well that we see as a natural partner to the liquid system. So the data from our projects were presented at WHO and endorsed by STAG, and the guidance issued, as I mentioned last month, stressing phased implementation as part of a comprehensive country plan for laboratory capacity strengthening, the detailed implementation issues that I mentioned, and then stressing the importance of specimen collection, rapid transport, and rapid reporting of results. FIND and BD announced a new midget pricing structure just a few days ago that will provide for midget culture and the growth supplement, the tube and the supplement, for under $3 per test, which compares quite favorably with solid culture. And data on cost and impact are being collected. just to point out that direct testing on the midget systems possible, though it hasn't been well investigated. There's a study reported in 2001 indicating reasonable comparability between direct DST testing for isoniazid and very good rates for rifampin resistance in terms of sensitivity and specificity, and then a significant decrease in time to detection by doing direct testing, that is, inoculating the tubes, growth, and drug tubes with specimen rather than culture. Very briefly, a technique that is getting a lot of attention, microscopic observation of drug susceptibility, pioneered by David Moore from his work in Peru, and highlighted in the journal publication, where liquid media, the same used for midget, is put into microtiter plate wells that contain drug and drug-free wells, and then growth is observed through an inverted light microscope looking for or cording of growth that is detected, with the cording being highly specific for M. tuberculosis. And the data in the New England Journal paper, they found that with this system, it was actually more sensitive than liquid culture on the automated mycobacterial culture on the BacT-Alert system, and more sensitive than solid, and a much more rapid time to detection. This is the MODS compared to the liquid culture and solid culture. Very, very excellent performance. The implementation issues that need further evaluation have to do with standardized procedures and actually the development of a test kit, training, biosafety, and then the demonstration projects looking at some of the issues that we've addressed in ours. Finally, with molecular methods, there are two Lyme probe assays, PCR assays, for the direct detection of rifampin in intergenetics and rifampin isoniazid resistance from smear-positive sputum specimens. In the Hying genotype MTBDR assay, several publications suggesting very high sensitivity and specificity for TB drug resistance. It's a standard PCR assay with three steps, beginning with processed sputum, DNA extraction, amplification, and then hybridization on the strip. And a readout visually saying tuberculosis, yes, no, rifampin resistance, yes, no, isoniazid resistance based on both CAT-G and isoniazid A, yes, no. So this PLUS assay is a second generation that includes an additional probe for isoniazid resistance, can be performed on cultures, processed sputum, and even inactivated and dried sputum. High throughput's possible with over 200 tests done per day by a single technician. A very favorable cost that comes out to about 50% of the cost for conventional liquid culture and DST at the new negotiated prices. And data from actually two evaluation studies that have been completed in South Africa suggest extraordinarily good performance characteristics, 99% sensitivity, 100% specificity for MDR-TB. And as Tim mentioned, a large-scale study is underway now in four provinces, four laboratories in South Africa, and duplicating this in some other settings. And I won't go through the screening algorithm, but only to disagree on one point, and that is if you have a test result saying, yes, it's tuberculosis, it's not resistant, you do not need to do culture and DST. We're not doing that in our demonstration projects, but I expect that we'll find that. So in terms of implementation, setting up a molecular lab may actually be easier and less expensive than a new culture-capable laboratory. Biosafety concerns are much less of an issue, particularly if you inactivate or kill the specimen at the point of collection, because you don't need, in fact, you kill mycobacteria to begin the test. Technician training can be done, we know now, in a week or less. There needs to be rigorous attention to detail and SOPs to avoid amplicon contamination, and then concluding again. But you can have a rapid assay, but if transport time's slow and results reporting is slow, it doesn't have that much of an impact. Thank you for your attention.
Rick, thank you very much. Are there any questions for clarification? All our speakers appear to have been amazingly clear. Right. Thank you very much then, Rick. And we'll now move on to Professor Wim Sturm, who will talk about the role and value of molecular characterization of XDR-TB strains. Wim came from Amsterdam 14 years ago to head up the Department of Microbiology at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in Durban. And 1.5 years ago, he had the deanship of the Nelson Mandela School of Medicine added to his responsibilities. Wim, thank you for coming under those pressures.
Well, thank you for inviting me to give this talk. I changed the title a little bit, as you can see, from the characterization of TB strains into TB isolates, because I think that title is better. Molecular characterization can actually be defined in two different ways. Well, it's applied in two different ways. Genotyping, which you can see how that is defined, and then also the detection of genetic changes in specific genes. And I'm going to deal with the first one. I'm going to deal with general issues and highlight that with examples of how we applied genotyping to better understand the XDR epidemic in KwaZulu-Natal, the province where I practice. So an isolate is a microorganism of any species isolated from a specimen from a particular patient. And that's why when you try to understand an epidemic, you need genotype isolates and not so much strains. Identification of a strain, which is a well-characterized organism within a species, is the result of the genotyping. So isolates with identical genotype belong to one strain, and strains with similar related genotypes form a family of strains, and a species includes a variable number of strains, and I give a few examples here where it comes to Mycobacterium tuberculosis. Now, this is the KZN strain, as we labeled this in 1995. It was one strain where all isolates had the same IS6110 fingerprint. And now in 2005 and later on, this has grown into a family of strains. Still have the basic profile, but there is quite a bit of variation. So genotyping methods differ in discriminating power. And when you want to increase that power, you need to apply multiple methods, and that asks the question, where do you stop? There are plenty of technologies available, and the more you apply, the more discrimination you get. Now, what you use depends on the species that you work with and what you want to achieve with your genotyping methodology. And I'm not going to go into detail regarding the different methods that everybody can read on, but the methods used most frequently for genotyping Mycobacterium tuberculosis is this the gold standard for typing, which is the IS6110 RFLP methodology. Nowadays, there's lots of laboratories that use polygotyping. There is the PGRS methodology, and there is now also the MIRU RFLP technique. This here shows you again the IS6110 RFLP methodology of isolates from the KZN family. And next to this is the spoligotyping. And it's just to demonstrate that these different methodologies have different discrimination power. As you can see, the spoligotyping for this family of strains is exactly identical, while the RFLPs differ significantly. And that has to be kept in mind when you talk about genotyping and the result and the conclusions that you draw from that. So what's the role in general of molecular characterization of microbes? Well, it gives the possibility of better understanding the host-microbe relationship for pathogenic microorganisms. That can be done through studying this, can use it to study the spread of a microbe within the population, differences in disease presentation in patients infected with the same species can be explained through genotyping methodology, differences in transmission efficacy between strains of organisms. You can evaluate the evolution of strains over time, that means virulence trends as well as drug resistance, and of course it can be used for outbreak investigation. Well, what are the questions that we try to answer using genotyping methodology in the XDR-TB epidemic in KwaZulu-Natal? Well, the first question is, is this secondary or primary resistance that we are dealing with? And in case of primary resistance, is this a clonal event or are there multiple events? And how widespread is it? Now, if we first look at this first question, the question to really be answered is, what is the ratio between isolates in genotype clusters and isolates with single genotypes? And I give you the results of, although you have much more data, the results of the 2005 Tugela-Ferry MDR isolates that we genotyped. We had 102 of those, and of those 60, that is of course almost 60%, belonged to this KZN strain. And of those 60 KZN strain MDR isolates, 52 were XDR. The 32 others, remaining strains were other genotypes, and of those, 9 were XDRs, and of those 9, 7 belong to the Beijing strain. So that means that if you calculate the ratio between clustering and single isolates, that's almost 1, which means that this is really a matter of recently acquired disease, and therefore it can be concluded that this is indeed primary resistance. That makes the questions in case of primary resistance relevant, and let's have a look at that. Clonal or multiple events, well, that question can be answered by the same data set. So we had 61 XDR isolates, the distribution I've told you already, 52 KZN strains, 7 Beijing, and 2 only with a different single fingerprint. And that's in the background of the fact that we have this KZN strain around since 1994 in an MDR form, and in a prison study, the largest prison in KwaZulu-Natal, we found in 2002 that the predominant strain in that setting was the Beijing strain. So, yes, in Tugela-Ferry we can conclude that it's largely clonal, but it's not a single isolator, it's also the Beijing strain around, so there are multiple events responsible for the Tugela-Ferry outbreak. Now, there are a couple of additional questions to be answered regarding clonal spread. The first one is the strain introduced in the area as an XDR, or did it develop locally in its XDR form due to antimicrobial selective pressure? And then, where does transmission take place? Is that in healthcare facilities only, in the community, or in both? And this table, this figure, demonstrates the first question. And as you can see, if I can, what you see here on the vertical axis is the resistance patterns of the organisms that are referred to, and on the horizontal axis is the time in years. And each of the blocks represents the first time that an isolate with this particular resistance pattern was found. And as you can see, in 1995 there was already MDR resistance within the KZN family. And this type of work could only be done because we had genotyping available to make sure that we were looking at the same strain. And this was the year 1995 that DOTS was introduced. And as you can see, this has further developed into more and more resistance, where ultimately in 2001 we had the first XDR isolate from this particular strain available. And that was the year in which the DOTS Plus program was introduced. So the conclusion of this is that indeed this is local development under antimicrobial selective pressure. Now, where does transmission take place? Is that in healthcare facilities or in the community? Well, here you see two X-rays of a patient from Tugela Ferry, and you can see here that the tuberculosis takes place in the right lower lobe, and that was drug susceptible tuberculosis. And here you see an area affected in the left upper lobe, and that was XDR-TB. Now, if you ask the question from each clinician without giving the clue whether that is the same patient or different patients, people will answer invariably that those patients are different. But it's in fact the same patient, having been admitted to this hospital, and this is an example of hospital-acquired XDR tuberculosis. Now, is this a single event? Well, no. We did a study which has just been submitted for publication, in which we looked at patients not responding to treatment or deteriorating within 30 days of initiation of treatment. It had to be 30 days after starting treatment or longer. And we found in a limited time period 43 of such patients, of which 35 had more than one culture positive. And of those 35, 23 had follow-up cultures with increased resistance as compared to the original one. Now, 9 of those patients moved from non-MDR to MDR, 13 from non-MDR to XDR, and 1 from MDR to XDR. Now, these 23 patients, 19 of them had one episode of reinfection or superinfection. It's difficult to differentiate between those two. And 4 had more than one episode, 3-2 and 1-3. That makes altogether 28 episodes of reinfection. And when we spoligotyped those isolates, we started with spoligotyping, knowing that it is impossible to fully differentiate between those if you get the same spoligotype. We found that we had one predominating spoligotype amongst the MDR cases and another amongst the XDR cases. And it will not come as a surprise that ST60 is in fact the spoligotype of the case at N-strain. So we didn't have to do any further IX611O RFLP because the spoligotypes in those patients were all different. Now, here you see the spoligotypes of one of those patients, the patient with the multiple episodes. It started with ST26, which was the susceptible spoligotype. Then the patient obtained the most prevalent ST34 MDR spoligotype, got an infection followed an infection with an XDR strain, ST53, and ultimately ended up with an XDR ST60. So, where does transmission take place? Well, it does take place in healthcare facilities. But does it also take place in the community? Well, this is data from the original Lancet paper at the end of last year, and that was a prospective study looking at patients that were reported to hospital and were suspected of having tuberculosis. Of those, 475 were culture positive, and ultimately there were 30 that were XDR, and the majority of those were the case at N-strain. So these were patients that were not in hospital but came to the facility with an XDR, infected with an XDR strain. So is there spread in the community? Yes, there is also spread in the community.
2 minutes.
The question now is, thank you. The question now is, how widespread is it? And so what we plan to do, we started to do, is prospective studies, so-called dirty studies, because we will not plan according to the rules set for such surveillance in different areas of the province. And what we plan to do is genotyping of isolates from such studies. Now, You must have seen from one of the posters yesterday that the number of healthcare facilities in which we found more than one case of XDR has increased over the last 2 years drastically, from 18 in early 2006 to a significantly higher number, 58, in the middle of 2007. That means that we found on average two cases in each of those those facilities with a variation between 1 to 15. Now, this is data without any denominator, so it doesn't tell you how many cases there really are because of the specific limitations of doing susceptibility tests at the moment in the South African policy. But here you see the outcome of the three surveillance surveys that we did in the five hospitals that we plan to do. So there is the Mosveld Hospital that's in the north of KwaZulu-Natal, and you see in the panel on the right that in that area there is a high percentage of MDR, but we didn't find any XDR. In Newcastle, there was not much drug resistance as compared to Mosveld and Tugela Ferry, for that matter, but the XDR, as it is in Tugela Ferry, is higher than the MDR. And then in Gantla, there is very little drug resistance, and there is no XDR in this particular part. Now, so two sites outstanding, Durban and Port Shepstone. Now, what these data tell us is that there is not a uniform distribution of XDR and MDR over the province. But we need our genotyping to be able to predict whether, for instance, the Mosveld region is just a step behind the Tugela Ferry area, and that if this is all the case at Enstein, we can expect, if we don't take drastic steps to prevent that, to get a similar situation as in Tugela Ferry. So, in conclusion, molecular characterization is a valuable tool that plays an important role in getting to understand the development and evolution of XDR tuberculosis. And if we really want to understand what's happening, we should be applying that on a larger scale. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Wim. Again, issues for clarification, reminding you that we will have enough time for discussion at the end. Again, another very clear presentation. Thanks very much to Wim. Moving the focus now away from diagnosis and characterizing strains to how to try to prevent their transmission, especially in congregate settings, I'd like to introduce Professor Edward Nardell, Associate Professor at Harvard Medical School of Public Health, and I think a lone voice for the need for infection control for many years. Ed is also a collaborator on our airborne infection research work in South Africa, and that's what he's going to present today. Thank you, Ed.
Thank you, Karen, invited me to do this as a co-organizer of the session. It's a little incestuous, but let me see here. Okay. So the topic of this whole session is challenges to managing MDR tuberculosis, and I think this picture presents an enormous challenge. This could be any open ward in Africa and in many other parts of the world. It happens to be a ward associated with the KwaZulu-Natal outbreak that Professor Strom spoke of, and I think Tony Moll will be speaking of, and we've heard so much about at this meeting. Again, you see that it's a bright and appears to be a very clean ward and with lots of windows, but At night, I suspect those windows are closed, and we have a real potential problem with transmission, as we just heard, with dramatic evidence of similar strains being passed around, probably in hospital and many other places. This is not new. Actually, it was way back in 1983 that I reported from a homeless shelter in Boston transmission of drug-resistant, not XDR by any means, drug-resistant tuberculosis, and even reinfection with tuberculosis in that setting. So we've been dealing with this for a very long time. So I'm not going to go through the outbreak, which we've heard so often, but it does serve to introduce this talk in many ways. So you see here that there was no prior treatment in many of these cases that were reported from KwaZulu-Natal of XDR-TB, and in fact, prior hospitalization was a prominent feature. Now, several times at this meeting so far, there's been reference to this interesting modeling exercise, which was published very, very recently. I read this on the plane here, and where the modeling exercise is to look at the effects of a variety, almost a comprehensive variety, of interventions that could take place in KwaZulu-Natal, and which it might avert an estimated 1,300 XDR cases that would result if the same pattern of transmission were to continue as has been observed up till now, between now and 2012. And it was estimated that as many as 50% of these would be nosocomially transmitted, and that the majority would be among HIV-infected persons. So the situation is much the same in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa, particularly in the rural areas, crowded single-room, 30-40 patient wards, many of them occupied by HIV-infected persons, to which patients with newly diagnosed TB are often either knowingly admitted or unknowingly admitted. Certainly we haven't spoken very much, we don't speak very much about the unsuspected case, but it's another huge source of transmission. What this paper goes on to do is to estimate the impact of a variety of interventions, and again, I'm not going to go through them in detail, but many of these interventions from community-based treatment, rapid drug susceptibility have, in this model, relatively small effects. In this model, environmental interventions seem to have a rather large effect. But one of the major points of this paper, I think, and one of the better points in the paper, is that when you combine a number of interventions, reducing the length of stay in hospitals, enforced use of respirators, et cetera, one gets a cumulative effect. When you add natural ventilation, you get a bigger effect. When you add drug susceptibility testing, et cetera, you get another boost to that. Many, many of these transmissions could be averted. One of the things about this paper is that, of course, these outcomes are only as good as the input that goes into it. And I would suggest that we know very little, actually, about the impact of very many of these interventions. There's relatively little evidence-based data out there on the impact of even the environmental interventions, which seem to have such an important effect. So what do we know about transmission of MDR-TB, or TB in general? And I like to think of this in the schematic way. We have known for years that there are a host of associated factors, or source of associated factors, rather, cough and sputum smear positivity and the absence of effective treatment or the presence of effective treatment all impact on the number of organisms that are generated into the air. We know that such factors as the ventilation and the volume of the room and the crowdedness of the room make a difference. Then there are factors we know very little about, the impact of environmental conditions such as air pollution or temperature and humidity on transmission. Then there are the host factors and the organism factors, which we think of as interacting in what we call virulence. And we know something about this. We've just heard about various strains and perhaps their virulence for humans, et cetera. And we certainly know that HIV and many other factors make this host very vulnerable. So we know something, but there certainly are major gaps in our understanding. Much of what we do know about transmission of TB goes back to these two gentlemen here, my mentor Richard Riley, and his mentor William Firth Wells. And this picture was taken by me in 1996, and Dr. Riley died not too long after that. But Wells had actually conceived of the concept of airborne transmission. Up to that time, it wasn't clear how organisms got from person to person for any infectious disease, and for this one in particular. Wells envisioned this experiment, and Riley carried it out in the 50s. So this is well over 50 years ago. And this was at the Baltimore VA Hospital in Baltimore. And it was a 6-bed hospital ward. And all the air was extracted up to a large exposure chamber in the penthouse, housing up to 200 and some guinea pigs. And so the guinea pigs were tested once a month, and they served as quantitative air samplers for TB. Well, why did they have to use guinea pigs? Well, they're highly susceptible to tuberculosis, and it's not possible to culture tuberculosis out of the air. You'll grow everything else, mold, environmental mycobacteria, but you won't grow tuberculosis under those settings. So those are a couple of the papers that document this experiment that took place, and it was really the experiment that proved that TB was airborne. And here are some of those results. About 2.6 guinea pigs got infected per month, not very many. He, however, used very strict criteria. I'm going to be showing you some other results where we've used perhaps looser criteria. And the relativity and infectivity of patients is shown here. You see that if you consider the untreated patients, and he did not treat patients for a while to study their infectivity, that was seemed to be okay at that time, but not today. So 29 guinea pigs were infected by these 61 patients, and if that's taken as 100%, then the 29 treated patients infected very few guinea pigs, and that was much less infectious. The drug-resistant patients, the untreated ones, infected fewer guinea pigs than the drug-susceptible patients, and if they were treated, they infected very few indeed. So this is the current, was our current understanding of transmission in a very elaborate experimental setup, and we felt that it was necessary to begin to address the current issues to repeat this experiment. And here you see the Airborne Infectious Research Facility that Karin mentioned, and this has been a collaboration over, I think, probably 7 or 8 years now. The Medical Research Council of South Africa, the CDC, Harvard School of Public Health and Harvard Medical School, and the CSIR, which is a research establishment also in South Africa, focused more on engineering. And this has been taken a long time to come to fruition, but is now exists. And actually, here are a more comprehensive list of the collaborators that have worked on this over the years and are continuing to work on this project. And I won't go through the long list, but we now have some funding from NIOSH, and we have other sources of funding for studying TB in the setting. So this is what it looks like. It's a part of a MDR treatment facility in Mpumalanga province, not far from Pretoria. There are 3 patient rooms that contain 2 beds each, and all of the air from this facility then goes through the ventilation system to an area that is not apparent to the patients who are here, in which up to 360 guinea pigs can occupy these cages and are breathing the air that the patients exhale. It is controlled by an elaborate electronic control system that monitors the ventilation that goes through the system, and we've been very fortunate to get some of that equipment donated. So we've done one experiment that is not even yet complete, and the purpose was to determine whether this facility actually worked as designed. We were a bit concerned because I showed you that data that in Raleigh's study, very few drug-resistant treated patients infected guinea pigs, and in our facility, all of the patients were going to be MDR and all of them on treatment. So we were afraid that the guinea pigs were going to grow old and never become infected. But in fact, we didn't see that. So 28 different patients occupied this facility over a four-month period. Approximately half of them were HIV positive. We chose patients intentionally based on having cough, on having positive smears, on having cavities. We wanted to see if this facility would work as planned. All of them, of course, though, were being treated. We tested the animals with 100 tuberculin units, a total of five times, and a small group got a sixth tuberculin test during the course of the 4 months, and we considered 6 millimeters as tentatively positive until we get to see the histopathology and the cultures. And then we sacrificed all the animals ultimately and preserved their tissues. This initial experiment was not funded to do everything we wanted to do, so we thought we would save the tissues and go back. So we did some very careful measurements of skin test reactions, and it's rather easy to do on a guinea pig in terms of determining the size of the reaction. Nothing's easy to do. And here are the results. Over a period of 4 months, we saw a progressive increase in the number of guinea pigs which became infected using 6 millimeters as positive. And by the end of the experiment, approximately 75% of the guinea pigs were reacting to tuberculin. Now, again, Riley only saw approximately 3 guinea pigs infected in a month, and we saw in 4 months, literally almost 300 guinea pigs infected. So some differences. Now, this is the size distribution of the skin tests on the guinea pigs, and it shows a mode here of 10 millimeters, which is what you see in guinea pigs, and a fairly normal distribution suggesting that we don't have to deal with BCG and we don't have to deal with atypical mycobacteria in this population. However, if you go to the fifth skin test, you see quite a difference. You see, again, a mode around 10 here, but then a group of skin tests that are now quite a bit larger. These are the same guinea pigs being tested again and again. And we wondered where these large reactions were coming from. Were they early infections or recent infections that were getting smaller, or larger small reactions that were getting larger? And this analysis shows that, in fact, these were animals that we got infected early on in the course of exposure and apparently had smaller reactions that got larger with time as their antigenic burden increased. Now, we went back and wondered whether the skin testing was somehow not right, why we had so many infections with this. We were using a different tuberculin than Riley used, and so we went back and took 20 animals and tested them with different strengths of tuberculin and different brands of tuberculin. And we first look at those that had large skin test reactions as more than 15 millimeters, and you'll notice that most of the reactions get smaller. Now, this is the same skin test material. The others are different materials, so look at this one. And one of them, interestingly, became entirely negative after having been positive. In fact, significantly positive.
Ed, you've got a couple of minutes.
Okay. So if we look at the small reactors, however, and these were 10 millimeters or less, we see that on retesting that many of them became negative. So we're calling this actually evidence for reversion, transient tuberculosis infection. And in fact, about a third of the animals that were reacting in this intermediate range, reverted. Those that had very large reactions, none of them reverted. And we also saw evidence of reinfection. Animals that became positive, became negative, became positive again. This shouldn't be too surprising. In Riley's data, of those with the 6 to 13 millimeter range without necrosis on the skin test, he also saw a very low correlation with actual persistent or progressive infection. So there seems to be something about MDR-TB that even an animal as susceptible as the guinea pig can result in transient infection. This is also being seen in humans. On skin test reactions, there's increasing evidence that maybe our concept that once infected, always infected, may be not entirely true. BCG is probably the most dramatic example where one has transient infection and even a transient skin test reaction. Well, our future experiments, and I'm going to close, we have the capacity here to do quite a bit. We are going to look at a variety of factors, including strain, dose, characteristics of the host, and let me move ahead here. We're going to also test a number of interventions. We're going to look at masks on patients and see how effective that is. We're going to look at portable air disinfection units, upper room UV, and a variety of novel things that we haven't even seen in use yet. This is just a kind of upper room UV we'll be testing. And what happens is the air is delivered to the guinea pigs. Every other day you can do an intervention and expose one guinea pig colony or the other on every other day and compare the rates of infection between the two colonies and get a very direct measure of the effect of the intervention in the room. Conclusion so far, this is MDR-TB seems to be highly transmissible to susceptible guinea pigs, as we've seen in highly susceptible humans. And it's, but however, we are seeing evidence of at least some some of these strains probably not being not very virulent, others appear to be. And that's also echoed in the human literature. So I think we have a very powerful model for looking at interventions and studying the biology, particularly of MDR-TB, and to help with the characterization of these strains in terms of their pathogenicity for guinea pigs and by reflection for highly immunosuppressed people. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Ed. I think in the interest of having a really good discussion session at the end, we'll move on. If those who have questions for Ed can hold them just for a few minutes, we've got one more speaker. And this is Dr. Tony Moll, who is the ARV program manager from Tugela Ferry. And I think we're all aware that Tony's work and that of his colleagues from Tugela Ferry and Yale and elsewhere has really been a tipping point in gaining attention for drug resistance in the TB community. Tony, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dr. Pullman. It's my pleasure to be here this afternoon and to share with you some first-hand experience of our Tugela Ferry event. Just to locate Tugela Ferry on the map then with you, it is more or less bang center in the province of KwaZulu-Natal on the east coast of southern Africa. And our hospital serves a catchment area of about 1,800 square kilometers, with a population of about 200,000 traditional people. And we have a caseload of TB, 1,000 in 100,000 population members. We also have an HIV burden, 25% of antenatal attendees. So right here in Tugela Ferry, we have a rural 350-bed hospital, very busy, lots of outpatients, busy night work, lots of hustle and bustle. In February 2005, we submitted 45 sputum samples for DST. This was on a hunch that something serious was happening in our hospital. Out of these 45 patients, the first 10 XDR patients were identified. We got these results about May 2005. Immediately in June, we started with an increased stepped-up surveillance. And then by February 2006, we had written up the profile of 53 XDR patients, which was published and presented in CROI and Toronto. Right now, as of 2007, we now have a total of 471 as of September, and out of these, 43% were MDR and 57% were XDR. 266 patients so far identified with XDR at our little hospital. The mortality rates are high, with a death rate of 66% among MDR and 84% among XDR. Is this an isolated vent, or is this the tail of the elephant? And this was a repeated question that was coming to us by politicians, by our management, etc. Were we touching the tip of the iceberg, or were we just looking through the keyhole and seeing something that was happening at Tugela Ferry, but not knowing what was happening in the rest of the room? Whilst we were grappling with this question, we responded locally, and that's what my talk is going to go about today. But there was also a provincial response. which released massive funds in our province to beef up the TB program as a whole. We also improved our central laboratory capacity based in Durban, and they now are doing up to 14,000 sputum specimens per month, which is quite incredible. They are really stretching at the seams. We have started with point prevalence survey, and Prof. Sturm did present that earlier on, and we are developing 7 MDR satellite facilities that are being established in the province to cope with extra load. We are an under-resourced area, as I alluded to, with high levels of unemployment and poverty, unacceptable water and food security, and poor infrastructure and communication and transport. However, we have some privileged resources. We have DST available for 6 different drugs. We have Prof. Sturm's laboratory at UKZN providing research support, and some of that research was presented here. And we are currently submitting sputum samples on every single TB suspect coming into our hospital. And we have the full spectrum of second-line drugs available. For the first time in many years, we right now have adequate resources to implement the TB program guidelines. And we certainly do have a very supportive district and provincial management. But this is not business as usual. The landscape in the last 3 years has changed so dramatically every few months. And it's been very hard for us as a little rural hospital to try and keep up with the MDR TB epidemic. And there's been, and this has been caused by significant MDR caseload right across the province, right, overburdening the health systems in our province with, as I said, the lab capacity absolutely stretched, not enough beds for the MDR TB patients to be accepted in our referral hospital in Durban, and the slow process of placing trained staff in the TB program. Right from the beginning, we realized that we were dealing with a nosocomial spread into Gallifrey. And what I'm showing you here are some incredible photographs of congregate settings in our hospital. And for the very first time, we were introduced to this new ball game of airborne infection control. And I can say it's new because our hospital wasn't designed for airborne infection control. We weren't thinking of airborne infection control. We're thinking of HIV spread and needle stick injuries and surface contact, that type of thing, washing hands regularly. Airborne control really in our hospital was very much something that came out of the blue. So we didn't even have infection control policies, so these had to be actually drawn up and written, and they are in the process of being approved now, and a lot of the things that we've written in those policies are already being worked out. Then we have this problem of separation of the highly infectious patients from the highly susceptible patients, and we had to re-look at this, and an example is the TB patients attending ARV literacy sessions in those congregate settings that I showed you photographs of. And so we are now screening patients at entry points, identifying high-risk areas, and rescheduling of our clinics so as not to mix patients together. Isolation has been a much more difficult problem to address in our hospital. And this is compounded by the fact that there's this huge time delay, because at the bedside, when a patient comes in, especially if they're really HIV immune compromised, to tell the difference between TB, MDR and XDR TB, you can't do it without a laboratory result. And that takes 6 to 8 weeks. So these patients are together before you have the results, and which enable you to separate the patients. And so once a patient is confirmed, we have been able to transfer these patients either to Greytown Hospital or to King George Hospital in Durban. Right. We are still not able to isolate our suspects, and what we would like to do ideally is to separate our large wards into clusters of 5 or 10 by compartmentalization. Well, going along with the rest of airborne infection control, we had to understand ventilation dynamics. And ideally, you would like to achieve 12 full air volume changes in a room per hour to be safe. And the question comes, what happens in cold winters when all our windows and doors are closed and patients are huddled up in bed and coughing together? And so we were able to, through the Department of Health, to augment with exchanges in such circumstances with mechanical ventilation. And these are the ducts here in the photographs and the outlets taking contaminated air outside. This is the exact same photograph that Dr. Nordell showed us a few moments ago, taken in Tugela Ferry, male TB ward. It's an overcrowded ward with 35 beds in it. As you can see, there are lots of windows and mixing fans on the roof. Now, how many air exchanges would you think we could achieve here by just opening the windows on a clear, quiet day? Well, the answer is 67, which is more than adequate and would make everybody feel quite at rest. What about if the windows are closed and we put on the mechanical ventilation? We would achieve 16, which would still be satisfactory. What about if you have all the windows closed, all the doors closed, and this is real scary, you have less than one air exchange per hour. So this is just something that very easily could drive nosocomial infection during the winter months. Since January 2005, we have lost 8 staff members in our hospital to MDR or XDR. 4 to MDR and 4 to XDR. And this has had a profound effect on our staff. And I can remember one morning being in the DOT office when the news came that during the weekend one of their staff members in the DOT office had died over the weekend at another hospital. And just sitting with the DOT staff and feeling that devastation and that fear was really tangible. So we created an awareness amongst our staff of airborne transmission, and we offered the staff the opportunity to relocate to a low-risk area if they were HIV positive. And just recently, after a staff member had died again of XDR-TB, I had the whole ARV staff in front of me, about 35 people, and I said, please, people, can't mess around with this. If any of you are HIV positive, tell us and we'll relocate you. After a while, one of the nurses put up their hand and said, Doctor, this is not practical, because if we did that, there would not be many people left in your department. So we're finding that patients, the staff members, are actually afraid of losing their jobs and afraid of being identified if they are sort of suddenly changed to another department. And what our staff found a lot more acceptable was to say, okay, if you are HIV positive, let us find out what your CD4 count is, and we rather introduce antiretroviral therapy at a higher CD4 count. And within a week, I started 3 or 4 staff members on antiretroviral therapies at higher CD4 counts. We started a staff screening program, and just to underline again that the high morbidity and the high mortality in our TB wards creates fear in staff, and staff certainly do fear working in the isolation facilities. What has been encouraging was the mathematical model presented here, which shows that staff deaths and casualties certainly can be minimized by the use of N95 masks and relocation of staff to other areas. And right now, if you walk into any of our TB wards and our medical wards, you'll find every single staff member wearing an N95 mask. With the integration of TB, when you want to try and achieve total integration, you have this problem of bringing highly vulnerable and highly contagious patients together, plus the problem of a huge pool of co-infected patients. So we've adopted a partially integrated program where still you can have one stop wherever you enter. If you enter at the TB clinic, we will provide you with VCT and ARV therapy, and if you enter at the ARV clinic, you will be provided with TB initiation, TB screening, and TB follow-up. Right. With contact tracing, and this was done with the help of the Italian Corporation and the Department of Health, we followed up every single MDR and XDR patient that we've identified in the last while. And the family home visits were done and screened immediately after the index patient was identified. And we went through 2,240 contacts that were traced and screened. And out of those contacts, we only picked up 1.3% of community spread. And we are going to follow that up now with a second round where we will revisit those same homes and see if after a time of 6 months, a year or 2 years, there are any more contacts that have contracted XDR-TB. MDR treatment in the community. In fact, we've been forced by circumstances to go this route. Because of the high burden of MDR-TB treatment, our receiving referral hospital has not been able to accept these patients for admission. And so the situation occurs where we send patients and on the same day they come back with their packet of MDR treatment and injectables in a bag. If they're very ill, we will admit them to our peripheral hospital. But if they're not that ill, we will certainly look after them in the community, either for them to get their daily injections at a local clinic or their injections received at home. So one of the projects that we're going to embark on now is to really formalize this into a professional service that can be seen as a best practice model. So at the moment we've got injection teams on wheels that go out. They don't go out 7 days a week as I've got here. They go out 5 days a week and we make other arrangements for the other 2 days. And we'll be building in treatment literacy, side effect monitoring and contact screening. Right. And obviously this issue of infection control in the community comes into play.
2 minutes, Tony.
I'll be able to finish in 2 minutes, thank you. With treatment, there are very limited treatment options. The treatment has a long duration. The drugs have a high side effect profile, toxicity and cost, and a low potency to go with it. MDR is resource intensive, and with ARVs, patients experience a very high pill burden, and ARV medications can potentiate side effects. And we've just come to realize that a fast, appropriate initiation of treatment is absolutely critical in our patients. And here you see the Tegelafiri resistant pattern, a 6-drug resistant pattern. The other drugs that you see here are not tested. We don't have the ability right now to test for them apart from the UKZN laboratory. And so you can see if you want to pick out a regime of 4 active drugs for these patients, there are very, very few options left over. And so what we do is we give our MDR patients and our XDR patients those regimes, and they are treated with those standardized regimes. And that is conducted at King George Hospital. This is my closing 2 slides. It says up to recently, Tegeleferi has had the lion's share of XDR in the province. But now, the rest of the province has overtaken Tegeleferi in case numbers. And in Prof. Sturm's updated slide, I can say that with at least one case identified in more than 58 facilities. Right. MDR and XDR are endemic in our province. The Tegeleferi experience could become widespread in terms of rapid nosocomial spread and high mortality, as the same ingredients that occur in our hospital can occur in many other hospitals across our province, allowing similar other events to happen. Thank you very much.
Tony, thank you very much indeed. We now have a good time for discussion. I'd like to invite all the presenters up onto the podium, please. We've got enough seats, I think. I would also like to, while they're coming up, to make an announcement that starting at... This is not an invitation to leave this room, by the way. But starting at 4 o'clock and going on until 5.30, there's a session on MDR-TB clinical trials in room 1.42. So I will vacate. Right, you've been very patient as an audience, so let us take a few questions, I think, and we'll sort of batch them a little bit and see if we can get... squeeze as many questions in as possible. Sir.
Dr. Şeref from Turkey. It's an amazing presentation group. Thank you for all speakers. My my concern is about Timothy's presentation about for HIV negative cases, you detect rifampicin resistant, rapid rifampicin resistant, and begin second-line drugs, four second-line drugs. I don't agree with it, this one, because really second-line drugs usage is very hard, and the success rate is also low. So these patients may have a high rate of success opportunity with the first-line drugs also. So for HIV negative group, this advice, I think, is not appropriate. Second point, yes, in the TB symposium, they mentioned that two sputum instead of three sputum in good working or quality-assured laboratories. But when you write it or tell it anywhere, the second part of the sentence will be missed, and only two sputum will be used, as we see in the slide here. So let's not say two sputum. Let's continue with three sputum. And that does not add any work or any additional workload.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you very much. Perhaps the who would like to... We'll take a few more questions, but you might like to think about who will take the drug question. Who will take the drug question? Okay, there were some statements about the drugs, but Ernesto, would you like to clarify, or Karen, about the drug regimens? In a second, we'll take a few more questions. And Karen, you can clarify about the sputum because you presented that the other day. Okay.
Thank you.
Microphone here.
Yes, Lisa Nelson from CDC Mozambique. First of all, thanks to all the presenters for an excellent presentation. My question is to Dr. O'Brien principally, and I just would like to know a little bit more about the use of molecular techniques and liquid-based cultures for patients with posse bacillary disease, because particularly for HIV-infected patients and children, I'm wondering if molecular techniques will work in those settings and whether those would be settings where liquid-based culture media, which has great sensitivity, might be more useful, but I'd like to know. And just a comment quickly that I think it's really critical that when we think about laboratory methods, we also think about the training that goes along with it. Apart from the increased laboratory needs with TB, many of us are involved in HIV treatment scale-up issues, and we're renovating laboratories all over the place, and we have no staff to fill them. So I think that's a very critical issue.
Right. Karen, would you like to start? And then Rick, you respond.
Now, I was actually going to ask Tony to share his experience in Tegelaferi with treating MDR together with ART and also your XDR patients, and whether you would suggest any changes to the current policies for concomitant treatment.
Yes, there's been a lot of discussion about this, and I think discussion will continue about this, because very little is known about treating MDR, XDR together with ARV treatment. As you know, we do have a high mortality rate amongst our XDR patients as well as our MDR patients, but it does seem that those who have either started on ARV or have an opportunity to start on ARV before they die of XDR or MDR do better, right? And so we've got probably about 70 patients now that are on second-line drug, TB drugs, as well as on ARV therapy, and it does not seem to be a big problem. They seem to tolerate both fairly well.
Karen, could you summarize the policy on the two-sputa, please?
The policy on two-sputa that we presented early in the week makes the point, if you read the background document, that the early morning specimen still has the highest possibility for a positive yield. So depending on the situation in the country, we're still recommending the early morning specimen as one of the two. I'm not sure if we need to elaborate more at this point.
In high burden, low resource issues?
The revised policy is particularly relevant. It's a pragmatic policy, I have to state, and it needs to be carefully considered at country level. But the focus areas would be those countries with a very high burden and those who have limited resources, which in this region probably means all countries.
Thank you very much. Rick?
Well, Lisa, you're certainly correct that liquid media are more sensitive for the isolation of mycobacteria and tuberculosis than solid media, particularly in posse bacillary specimens, so it would be very appropriate for smear negative and screening children with suspected tuberculosis. The current molecular assay that we're working with at FIND, the HINE assay, may actually perform reasonably well on smear-negative specimens as well. We have a small amount of data. Plus, there's work ongoing to improve the sensitivity, particularly on the DNA extraction process, and we may have an assay that works quite well on smear-negative. Your comment about human resources is right on. I mean, the limiting, maybe the most important limiting factor to scaling up capacity will be the huge increased need for highly trained personnel, the numbers in the tens of thousands for these culture laboratories that we say need to be developed, or even molecular facilities.
Do any of the panel want to say anything else about human resources? It's clearly a key issue. Well, think about it if it comes up, if it's appropriate later on. The gentleman in the red jacket at the back.
Greg Gonzalez from the AIDS and Rights Alliance for Southern Africa. This is for Tony and Karen and Dr. Sturm. Tony, you're saying you're implementing all these sort of policies at your hospital and saying that there's an influx of resources into the province, into the district, but what's not being done? You're saying now you see it in 58 different hospitals. You see it cases in the province overtaking it in the one hospital. What are we not doing that we need to be pushing for? I just want you to be sort of direct about it. It seems like it's probably not getting better, and just to give advocates in the room some idea of what we should be pushing for.
We take the question also from the gentleman in the front.
Rod Escombe, Imperial College London. A comment and a couple of questions for Tony Moll. I was delighted to see that you got 67 air changes in that ward by opening the windows, and that's great to see. I hope they're wide open during the summer months. And at night you can take out the glass of some of those windows to keep at least some ventilation during the evenings. You mentioned that 12 air changes an hour provided by the mechanical ventilation system should be adequate. I would contest that in such an overcrowded environment. In airborne infection models, it's absolute ventilation per person, which is important. So your 12 air changes gets divided by the number of people in that room. So you may find that 12 air changes is inadequate. In evaluating over 20 Peruvian hospitals for TB infection control, I was always disappointed to find mechanical ventilation systems were almost exclusively poorly designed, poorly installed, and never maintained. The only one that was maintained was the one in the hospital where I worked, because I was the one who maintained it. My question to you is whether you have a budget and expertise set aside for the maintenance of your new mechanical ventilation system. And my other question is...
I think you should probably give others a chance, Rod.
So just very quickly, those waiting areas, have you had any infection control interventions in those waiting areas that you showed the photos of? Thank you.
Tony, would you like to take the what's not being done question and then some of the air change questions? But I think the 12 air changes an hour challenge should probably be addressed by Ed. Carry on. Tony first.
Okay. Thank you. When you look at a province like KwaZulu-Natal, identifying nearly 100,000 TB cases per year, which are the figures for the last two or three years, just short of 100,000, to change that TB program as a whole across the province, looking at more than 60 facilities, is no small task. It's not going to happen overnight, okay? And I think with somebody like Bruce Mulgo at our helm in KwaZulu-Natal, we have seen heaven and earth move, and an incredible amount has been done in our province, and I really give all my honour and praise to our management for that. I would like to see surveillance stepped up in a clear and concise and in a well-planned way. We've just started in a small way, and that should be stepped up. And I would like to see case detection for MDR and XDR being made more widely available right across our province. And if one could achieve every suspect has access to DST, that would be incredible to do. Our labs probably really couldn't cope at the moment, so there is a laboratory problem. Then I would like infection control and the options for isolation to be taken a lot more seriously, and for standard policies to be adopted and implemented in rural hospitals and city hospitals. That's just a start, quite a big start, I think.
Ed? This is to do with the ventilation question that Rod has raised. Rod, I would disagree, or at least I'm not so sure that the number of air changes gets divided by the number of people on the ward. That's certainly true of comfort ventilation, where we all generate CO2 and we all generate heat. But when you're talking about a ward where we certainly don't think 35 patients are generating XDR-TB, it's some smaller number, that I think the numbers of air changes is a reasonable way to go. Having said that, I'd much rather have 35 air changes if I were working in that ward than 16 air changes. But there are practical limits, and if people close the windows at night, we have to worry about the 0.3 air changes and improve on that, certainly. That's, the really source of transmission. And if we got to 16, I think that would be pretty good.
Thank you. Gentleman has been waiting patiently in the middle there.
Yeah, hello. I'm Tore Steen from Botswana. I just have a question for Dr. Moll. You said you had started with the screening procedures for staff. I just wondered if you could tell us a little bit more about what kind of screening you are doing for staff. Thanks.
And gentleman behind you, Dr. Catanzaro.
Yeah, Tony Catanzaro from San Diego, USA. I was curious how come no one's talked about ultraviolet irradiation. I know that Ed's had a lot of experience with that. And I've seen it work quite well in Tijuana, for example, fairly recently. I know there are a lot of problems, but I'd like to hear some discussion because it seems like an ideal intervention for the huge problem that you've described with highly infectious air.
Thanks. Tony, will you take the staff screening question?
So screening takes place in two steps. You have your baseline screening and your follow-up screening. So any new staff that is taking up a new post in the hospital will have baseline screening, which will be a questionnaire concerning signs and symptoms of TB, previous episodes of TB, treatment of TB, and the option of disclosing an HIV status. Right. And then staff already employed will undergo follow-up screening, which would entail every 6 months a weight and a symptom check on that person, and if something positive comes out of that, that will be followed obviously by sputum and a chest X-ray and other investigations, right? And weight apparently is quite a sensitive indicator.
Ultraviolet, we probably didn't give you enough time to get into that. Now's your chance.
Right. Well, thanks, Tony, for raising that. I didn't ask you to say that. I think many of us have a great deal of hope that ultraviolet will play a role in many of these large settings, particularly. There's plenty of room experimental data showing very high equivalent levels of air disinfection under very controlled conditions. I think what we don't know is how well ultraviolet works in reality in wards such as the one that we've seen pictures of. And we hope to approximate that in the air facility by testing UV, the very first intervention we're going to test. And we need to know whether you need to have mixing fans or you don't, and whether high humidity really negates a lot of the effect or not. And then finally, let me say there's an awful lot of misunderstanding about UV. Sometimes you mention and people say, oh, immediately, oh, they get dusty and they don't work, or they require a lot of maintenance, et cetera. And there's a lot of lack of expertise both in producing the fixtures and in knowing how to install them. So we have a lot of work ahead of us to bring this up to the level of broad application, but I think it is a useful thing. When we work in Siberia, for example, opening the windows is not an option. And and ventilation with extremely cold temperatures outside is also not an option. So ultraviolet really has an important role, I think, in many parts of the world, maybe less so where you can open the windows.
Thank you very much, Ed. Lady in the front.
Hi, Sheila Shenoy from Yale University. This question is directed toward Dr. Nardell. I wonder if you could discuss a little bit looking at immunosuppression in the guinea pig model that you were presenting, especially since HIV factors so heavily.
I'm not sure I understand the question. Guinea pigs are so vulnerable to tuberculosis, they actually, even in the normal state, represent a very good a substitute for a ward full of HIV-infected persons. They readily get infected. They invariably progress to disease, except in the situations where we've shown with less virulent organisms. We were disturbed in this experiment that well into it, the guinea pigs didn't seem to be getting sick and dying, so we actually took half of them and treated them with dexamethasone for 3 weeks so that we would hopefully increase the bacteriologic yield so we'd be able to match the guinea pig isolates to the human isolates and be able to know which patients infected which guinea pigs. And we're waiting for those results in the next several months to be revealed by fingerprinting, et cetera, and we'll let you know next year what that showed. But I think it, the guinea pig itself is a highly vulnerable model for HIV.
Does that answer your question, or were you also concerned about immunosuppression in the patients? Could you come
yes.
to the mic?
Yes.
Okay, so it answers the question. Good. Anybody else? Yep.
Thank you very much, all the presenters. My question goes to Tony Moore. The community-based, the community model where patients are getting treatment from outpatient basis, do you first admit them and get them treated for a certain period of time so that you only release those who at least have received some treatment in the hospital, or do you just... or if the hospital is full, the rest are treated on community basis. Then the second one is, for those who are treated at home, what are the precautions, apart from the household contact tracing, what are the other precautions if one is a spouse? I mean, do they go wearing masks? Do they do different beds? I don't know.
I didn't hear the first part of the question very well. Shall I start with the second part?
The first
part
of the question is for the community-based care, people who are receiving community-based care, do you admit them to hospital to begin with, or do they go straight home?
If they're well enough, they go straight home, right, and they're initiated on community-based medicine, and they get their injections administered to them by the injection teams that drive out to their homes on a daily basis, right. And the second part of the question is in terms of infection control at home. So there are some basic things that we are talking about, infection control principles at home. If the patient at all can stay in a separate room, that would be good. Cough hygiene for that patient. Taught basic principles of cough hygiene, how to cover the cough, how to contain the spread of droplets into the air, goes a long way. Advice, for instance, to talk with groups rather outside than inside, if that's possible. The care of children comes into this, and advice is given about especially mothers who've got NDR and or XDR and looking after babies because of the intimate contact there. They need guidance about that. And such mothers can be given N95 masks as well if there's no one else to help them care for the baby. And then reassurance as well that it is airborne control and that the usual things that we advised our HIV patients about, hugging, using the same toilets, sharing utensils, and that one can reassure the patient concerning that as well. There's probably many other things that I've left out, but those are the most important things.
Tim, did you want to add?
I hate to put Tony on the hot seat under the bright lights again, but this is a more clinically related question about how often you're following your patients with sputum cultures. And also, I realize many of these patients were just detected. I know you have a high mortality, and they're probably not finished with treatment, but do you have any indication of sputum culture conversion rates in your cohort?
No, I don't have data on sputum culture conversion rates. We do sputum cultures every month,
okay,
on these patients that follow up. At the moment, they are still being followed up by King George Hospital. So King George Hospital still have the data of the sputum conversion rates.
Okay, I think that the time is drawing to a close and the questions are drying up at the same time. So Karen will kindly close the session. Thank our speakers.
Thank you. No, I want to really thank the speakers for excellent presentations and having been very clear, and for especially complying with DOT, directly observed timekeeping. You guys did well. Thank you for staying. Thank you for the questions. Enjoy the rest of the day.
Thank you.